President Oxnam, members of the faculty and members of the student body of this great institution of learning, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted and honored I am to be with you tonight and to be a part of your lecture series. It is always a very rich and rewarding experience when I can take a brief break from the day-to-day demands of our struggle in the South and discuss the issues involved in that struggle with college and university students. And so I can assure you that it is an honor and a privilege to be here. And I want to thank you for extending the invitation. It's good to renew old friendships. I'm very happy to be here with my teacher, Dr. George Kelsey, and his lovely wife, and other friends that I have in this area of New Jersey and in this area of our country. I would like to use as a subject from which to speak tonight the American dream. And I use this subject because America is essentially a dream. A dream yet unfulfilled. The substance of the dream is expressed in some very familiar words found in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is a dream. Now, one of the first things we notice about this dream is an amazing universalism. It does not say some men, it says all men. It does not say all white men, but it says all men, which includes black men. It doesn't say all Protestants, but it says all men, which includes Catholics. It doesn't say all Gentiles. It says all men, which includes Jews. And that is something else at the center of the American dream, which is one of the distinguishing points, one of the things that distinguishes it from other forms of government, particularly totalitarian systems. It says that each individual has certain basic rights that are neither derived from or conferred by the state. They are gifts from the hands of the Almighty God. Very seldom, if ever, in the history of the world has a socio-political document expressed in such profound, eloquent, and unequivocal language the dignity and the worth of human personality. But ever since the founding fathers of our nation dreamed this dream, America has been something of a schizophrenic personality, tragically divided against herself. On the one hand, we have proudly professed the great principles of democracy, On the other hand, we have sadly practiced the very antithesis of those principles. Indeed, slavery and racial segregation are strange paradoxes in the nation founded on the principle that all men are created equal. But now, more than ever before, our nation is challenged to realize this dream. For the shape of the world today does not afford us the luxury of an anemic democracy. And the price that America must pay for the continued oppression of the Negro and other minority groups is the price of its own destruction. The hour is late, and the clock of destiny is ticking out. We must act now before it is too late. Now I must hasten to say that we must not seek to solve this problem in America merely to meet the communist challenge. We must not seek to solve this problem in America merely to appeal to Asian and African peoples. In the final analysis, racial discrimination must be uprooted from American society because it is morally wrong. In the final analysis, we must get rid of segregation because it is sinful. In a real sense, it is a new form of slavery covered up with certain niceties of complexity. It is wrong to use the words of the great Jewish philosopher Martin Buber because it substitutes an I-it relationship for the I-thou relationship and relegates persons to the status of things. And so this problem must be solved not merely because it is diplomatically expedient, but because it is morally compelling. And so I would like to suggest some of the things that must be done in our nation if this American dream is to be realized. Some of the challenges that we face at this hour, and in facing the challenges, we will be able to bring this dream into full realization. I would like to start on the world scale, so to speak, by saying if the American dream is to be a reality, we must develop a world perspective. It goes without saying that the world in which we live is geographically one. And now more than ever before, we are challenged to make it one in terms of brotherhood. Now, it is true that the geographical oneness of this age has come into being to a large extent through man's scientific ingenuity. Man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance and place time in chains. And our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took weeks and even months. I think Bob Hope has adequately described this new jet age in which we live. He said it is an age in which it's possible to take a nonstop flight from Los Angeles, California to New York City, a distance of some 3,000 miles. And if on taking off in Los Angeles you develop hiccups, you will hick in Los Angeles and cup in New York City. You know, it is possible because of the time difference to take a jet flight from Tokyo, Japan on Sunday morning and arrive in Seattle, Washington on the preceding Saturday night. And when your friends meet you at the airport and ask when you left Tokyo, you will have to say, I left tomorrow. This is the kind of world in which we live. Now, this is a bit humorous, but I'm trying to laugh a basic fact into all of us. And it is simply this: through our scientific genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood. And now, through our moral and ethical commitment, we must make of it a brotherhood. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. This is the challenge of the hour. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. So somehow we are interdependent. I remember an experience that I had just a few years ago. Mrs. King and I had the privilege to journey to that great country known as India. I never will forget the experience of meeting and talking with the great leaders of India, meeting and talking with thousands and thousands of people in the cities and villages all over that vast country. These experiences will remain meaningful and dear to me as long as the cords of memory shall lengthen. But I must say to you that there were those depressing moments. How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes evidences of people by the millions going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes thousands of people sleeping on the sidewalks at night, no houses to go in, no beds to sleep in? How can one avoid being depressed when he discovers that out of India's population of more than 400 million people, some 375 million make an annual income of less than $80 a year, and most of these people have never seen a doctor or a dentist? As I noticed these conditions, something within me cried out, "Can we in America stand idly by and not be concerned?" And an answer came, "Oh, no." Because the destiny of the United States is tied up with the destiny of India and every other nation. And I started thinking about the fact that we spend millions of dollars a day in America to store surplus food. And I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge, in the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of God's children in Asia and Africa and South America and even our own country who go to bed hungry at night. It may well be that we've spent far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. All I'm saying is simply this, that all life is interrelated. And we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be, and you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of reality. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. I think this is the first challenge, and it is necessary to meet it in order to move on toward the realization of the American dream, the dream of men of all races, creeds, national backgrounds, living together as brothers. If the American dream is to be a reality, secondly, we must get rid of the notion once and for all that there are superior and inferior races. This idea still lingers around in some situations and in some circles. Certainly, the intellectual disciplines, the anthropological sciences, have made it very clear that there is no truth in this. Great anthropologists like Ruth Benedict, Margaret Mead, the late Melvin Herskovitz, and others have made it clear that as a result of their long years of study in these various areas, there is no truth in the idea of superior and inferior races. There may be superior and inferior individuals academically within all races, but there are no superior and inferior races. But in spite of this, the notion still lingers around. There was a time when people tried to justify this or tried to give some validity to this argument by turning to the Bible. And there again, it is a strange thing to see how individuals will use or misuse the Bible and religion to justify their prejudices and crystallize the status quo. And so from some pulpits around the nation, it was argued that the Negro was inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. The Apostle Paul's dictum became a watchword, "Servants, be obedient to your master." Then one other brother had probably read the logic of the great philosopher Aristotle, and you know Aristotle did a great deal to bring into being what we now know in philosophy as formal logic, and in formal logic you have the syllogism with its major premise and minor premise and conclusion. And this brother decided to put his argument of the inferiority of the Negro in the framework of an Aristotelian syllogism. He could say as his major premise, all men are made in the image of God. Then came the minor premise, God, as everybody knows, is not a Negro, therefore the Negro is not a man. This was the type of reasoning that prevailed. Now, on the whole, I think people have gotten away from that, not altogether, though, because I heard the other day where someone in Mississippi said that God was a charter member of the White Citizens Council. But on the whole, we've moved away from these arguments. Now it's done on subtle sociological grounds. The Negro is not culturally ready for integration. And if you integrate the schools and public facilities, you will pull the white race back a generation. And then other arguments come out. You see, the Negro is a criminal. And these arguments go on ad infinitum. The individuals who come forth with these arguments never go on to say that if there are lagging standards in the Negro community, they lag because of segregation and discrimination. And criminal responses are not racial, they are environmental. Poverty, ignorance, social isolation, economic deprivation breed crime, whatever the racial group may be. And it is a torturous logic to use the tragic results of segregation as an argument for the continuation of it. It is necessary to get to the causal basis. And I think that we have enough evidence in practical experiences and practical accomplishments of individuals in the Negro community and individuals and other minority groups to demonstrate that that is no truth, and the idea of the inferiority of the Negro race or the superiority of any other race. From an old slave cabin in Virginia's hills, Booker T. Washington rose to the position of one of America's great leaders. He lit a torch in Alabama and darkness fled. From the red hills of Gordon County, Georgia, in the arms of a mother who could neither read nor write, Roland Hayes rose to the point of being one of the world's great singers and carried his melodious voice into the palaces and mansions of kings and queens. From crippling, poverty-stricken circumstances in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, there came a Marian Anderson to be the world's greatest contralto, so that a Toscanini had to say a voice like this comes only once in a century. And Sibelius of Finland cried out, my roof is too low for such a voice. From difficult, crippling, oppressive circumstances, George Washington Carver rose up and carved for himself an imperishable niche in the annals of science. There was a start in the sky to female leadership. And then came a Mary McLeod Bethune and grabbed it and allowed it to shine in her life. With all of its radiant beauty, there was a start in the diplomatic sky. And then came a Ralph Bunch, a grandson of a slave preacher, and allowed it to shine in his life. These are just few examples, inspiring examples, to refute the idea of the biological inferiority of the Negro. And they justify the conviction of the poet, fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in black and white the same. Were I so tall as to reach the pole or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man.